This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on March the 1st, 2007. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. I'd like to call to order the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, March 1st, 2007. The first item on our agenda is the correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of the minutes of an open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, February 22nd, 2007, as set forth in Agenda Document 0713.
Very good. The Vice Chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Madam Secretary, if you could record that the Vice Chairman's motion was adopted by a vote of 5-0 with Commissioner Schroner absent today. The second item on our agenda involves Draft Advisory Opinion 2007-03 by Senator Barack Obama and the Obama Exploratory Committee. We have presenting Mr. Ron Katwan and Amy Rothstein from the Office of General Counsel. Mr. Katwan. I apologize. I've just been reminded by the Vice Chairman. We do have a procedural step before we begin our discussion, which is that we have a late submitted document. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider Agenda Document 0712A.
Very good. The Vice Chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. I'm sorry, Mr. Katwan.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The draft advisory opinion before your response to request on behalf of Senator Barack Obama and Obama for America, his principal campaign committee. The request asks whether Senator Obama may solicit and receive contributions for the 2008 presidential general election without losing his eligibility to receive public funds if he receives his party's nomination for president. To preserve his eligibility to receive public funds, Senator Obama proposes first, to deposit all private contributions designated for the general election in a separate account. Second, to restrict access to the account. And third, to refrain from using any funds in that account until he has decided whether to receive public funds for the general election. If Senator Obama becomes a candidate in the general election and decides to receive public funds, he would refund all private contributions from the separate account in full. The draft concludes that, under the facts presented here, Senator Obama may solicit and receive private contributions for the 2008 presidential general election without waiving eligibility to receive public funds. If Senator Obama decides to receive public funding, then he must refund all contributions designated for the general election in full within 60 days after Senator Obama certifies his eligibility to receive public funds under 11 CFR 9003.282. The Commission received one comment on the draft, and I will be happy to address any questions. Thank you.
Very good. Discussion? No? Okay. Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to start by addressing the amendments, but rather I just wanted to address the general topic. First, to note that the overall enterprise that I think all of us are about and all of us agree on is preserving the flexibility for candidates to get back into the public financing program for the general election if they choose to do that. And I think that is a policy objective that we all agree on and we all agree is a worthy one. And I just want to note that it requires, as all of us understand and as some people who've commented have noted, a little bit of flexibility in terms of the procedures. We're using distinctions between solicit and receive and accept in a highly technical way to get to what I think we all agree is an acceptable policy result. And in other contexts, that's sometimes called creating loopholes or not enforcing the law or something like that. And I just want to make the point in passing that those concerns are expressed, I think, largely when people disagree about the policy result that we're getting to. And that's fine, power, that flexibility can be used for good purposes or bad ones, and whether you assess them as good or bad may well depend upon your outlook. But I just find it curious that some of the people who sometimes criticize us for flexibility are happy to see it here, and I'm happy with them. I also want to note, as all of us understand, and one of the amendments gets to this issue, that this is probably not the last time we will have to face this issue. We may be here a year from now after a round of February primaries with another candidate who has a slightly different factual circumstance or somewhat more concern to me. We may be here a year and a half from now on the eve of a party convention trying to work out something related to this. While I personally would have preferred to put a little more structural support behind our opinion, I understand my colleagues' reservations in that regard, but I just want to outline now, in case it does happen, some of my concerns about some of the things that might happen, and specifically because I don't want to be in the position, for instance, of having someone come to the commission and say, well, my circumstances are somewhat different, and can I do X, Y, and Z, and in essence have the commission be in the position of if Senator Obama or someone situated just as he is wins the nomination, issues this challenge to their general election opponent, and the general election opponent turns around and says, well, I'd love to take you up on that, but the FEC tells me I can't. Okay? I don't want us to be there because I don't think we ought to be playing that kind of a role, you know, in the presidential process, either having, frankly, to exercise that critical of a decision-making function at a late point in the process, being used, if we're being used or maneuvered into a position by parties to try to gain advantage one way or the other. The other place this could come up, obviously, is in the case of the vice presidential nominee, who's going to be under the same restrictions. And I don't think any of us would want the commission to be in the position of, as it were, vetting the vice presidential nominees to see whether or not it would be okay for a presidential nominee who wants to accept public funding to nominate this particular person to be vice president. And so I'm a little bit concerned that there are unanswered questions here, but no matter what we do, we're not going to be able to answer them all today, it may well require some further exploration later on. That being the case, I think it's the proper policy result here on the facts presented to give this answer, and at some point, I don't want to cut off other more general discussion, but I'd be happy to offer these amendments as well.
Very good. Yes, no, I think that we all are aware that this this question presents itself in the context of a situation where, for the first time since 1976, the public financing system may not be used by either candidate for either major party in either the primary or the general election. The reality of that may be that the public financing system is no longer viable, and that this opinion is being considered in that context. We have, we'll vote in a few minutes. We'll see how it turns out. But I predict that we will approve the draft and answer the question presented by Senator Obama in the affirmative, that he can do what he is proposing here. Or if he does what he is doing here, then he could still qualify. That result was not a foregone conclusion. We spent time thinking about that, and we received, I thought, very constructive and thoughtful comments from the Campaign Legal Center and from Democracy 21 that argued for a different outcome. And while we ultimately chose a different analysis and interpretation of the statute, I thought that those comments and the time and energy that people put into spending those comments were very, very helpful. Much of the discussion we've had around this and the thinking that has gone into this in the last couple of weeks has been about the implications. What next? because I thought my sense was that the question presented was easier to solve than the questions which were not presented. We have thought through, and Commissioner Vice Chairman Mason has just alluded to a number of the implications or the unanswered questions that present themselves, specifically for candidates that do not find themselves in exactly the situation that Senator Obama finds himself in. There are questions related to for example, candidates that have already begun raising money for the general election and have spent some of that to cover fundraising costs. Senator Obama has set forth that he will segregate these funds and use none of them, and that was important in our reaching this decision. What are the implications for candidates who, you know, in the period prior to the issuance of this advisor opinion, did spend some of those funds they were permitted to by law? Does that change the outcome? Senator Obama has indicated that he will put these in a separately segregated fund. For candidates in other contexts, that is not required by our regulations. Candidates can commingle their general and primary election funds in a single account. What if somebody has done that? Could they cure that and transfer those funds out, or would they have to? I mean, there are many, I think, unanswered questions. We have done the simpler task of asking the questions which were asked of us, but I think for candidates in somewhat different circumstances, there are many unanswered questions. The point I would like to emphasize is that we explicitly in this advisor opinion and more generally encourage candidates that are considering following this path or who think, as Vice Chairman Mason has indicated, that come convention time they might want to take advantage or accept the proposal presented by Senator Obama, that they ask about what they would have to do now. We have tried to move this on an expedited basis. We're answering this question approximately 30 days after it was asked of us, about half the time that we're permitted under the statute. And looking back at last year, answered a number of these expedited advisory opinions in more like a 20-day time period. And there's no doubt that a lot of work on the general counsel's side among the commissioners here was put into trying to move this out as quickly as we could so that we were able to provide answers in a real-time framework for the campaigns and for people trying to make these decisions. And I'm sure on their side they think 30 days is very long. But we have begun thinking about already how other parts of our regulations would impact or affect other kinds of candidates and other kinds of fact patterns already. So hopefully, to the degree that other candidates are interested in doing something like this, they will ask our views. Hopefully, we will be able to respond in a prompt way in answering those questions and the concerns that the Vice Chairman has, which I think we all share, of finding ourselves a year and a half from now having to answer questions that are made much harder by people having engaged in a lot of different kinds of conduct already, won't present itself. Other thoughts? Commissioner Von Spakovsky. One day soon.
Anticipating.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to make four points, and the first one, I think, is to follow up on something you just mentioned. And I really want to thank the staff for the speed with which and the good work they've done on this. And the public needs to know, from the time the request for an opinion came in to the time we're sitting here today for a vote is less than a month. And I don't think you'll find many federal agencies in this town who can issue an advisory opinion, which is a major piece of work and has great ramifications in that kind of a time period. And that's a credit to our staff and a credit to the commissioners who are requiring this kind of work and to make sure that when we do something, we are sensitive, particularly in the election area, of getting a fast answer out. I also think we are well within the law and the opinion we're giving, and that this situation, although it's not covered explicitly in our regulations, is extremely similar to a situation that we've had for many years, and it is covered by our regulations. And that's the fact that any individual running for Congress has the ability under our regulations today during the primary season to raise contributions not just for the primary election but also for the general election, despite the fact that they may lose the primary and not be in the general election. And normally, if they are accepting contributions in that situation, then that would be considered an excess contribution. They would be in violation of the law. But what our regulations say is you can raise contributions for both elections. If you then lose the primary, so you're not going to be in the general election, you've got 60 days to return and refund the contribution you raised for the general election. This situation is, to me, almost exactly the same. I think not only are we well within the law and the regulations, but this is a good policy result. We all know that the public funding system rests on a very fragile base because the amount of funding for it has not kept up with the reality of elections and the soaring cost of running a national election for the presidency and the vice presidency. The final thing I'll say is, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the work that you and the vice chairman have done, particularly with these final amendments, which I think take care of some of the other concerns that the commissioners had. I intend to support both the amendments and the main advisory opinion, and I would say, given the early start that we've had to this presidential campaign season, somebody has already said to what is a very crowded field, in fact, the most crowded field I think I've seen, they've already been told the equivalent of, and we recently had a NASCAR case before us, of gentlemen and ladies, in this case, start your engines. And with this advisory opinion, when we adopt it, I think we'll be waving the green flag for the real start of the race. Thank you.
Very good. Other Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's interesting that Commissioner Von Spakovsky was thinking of NASCAR, because I had a similar image in mind as I was thinking about this. I mean, obviously, we could have come to a different conclusion, and it's really a pleasure to come to the table on a day like today where the Commission has worked hard to reach a consensus, and I think we are all in agreement on this, and it shows that the agency is working well, working hard and working well. We could have come to a different conclusion, but I think we're coming to the right conclusion. I think it would be wrong for the agency to stand on a wooden interpretation of its regulations and of the statute while the public financing system crashes and burns. It's my allusion to NASCAR. I think that also as an old compliance hand, you know, we're just coming off of what I think really has objectively can only be described as a very successful year for the Commission, where we collected record penalties. But it gives me no pleasure to collect huge amounts of money from people who have violated the law. I would far prefer that they not violate the law in the first place, and a very good way of avoiding that is to ask for advice in advance of doing something, particularly if you're kind of on the edge. I appreciate Senator Obama's ingenuity and his innovation, and I also think he's being very cautious in his approach, and I appreciate that as well, that he came in and asked beforehand. I think it's a good policy result that we're adopting here, and I think it's well-founded. And like many of the results that we achieve, you know, one can argue it this way or one can argue it that way, but I think we are coming to the better result, and I will be pleased to support the result and the amendments.
Thank you. Commissioner Walther?
Just to add to that, I also want to thank the staff, too, because I know when this came in, we've been under a lot of pressure to do some other things, and the priority was clearly to get this out as quickly as we could, understanding the importance of it and to some degree the novelty of the question. So Ms. Duncan and Ms. Smith and Mr. Katwan and Ms. Rothstein deserve special recognition for the willingness to get this done in such a quick way and to be helpful to us in the deliberation process. The one of the amendments to be made today is to eliminate the word escrow in terms of the kind of account. And it had concern to me when that was thought to be removed. And there's a technical argument for it that I can understand, but it, to me, should not be viewed as a change in the approach that was offered by the counsel for Senator Obama. And really what the Chairman Lenhardt said, I agree with very much, and that is that this is a little different, and it's helpful to us that it was seen to be more of a, and I'd like to consider it as a trust relationship that's being created, using these funds strictly for trust purposes. And so the word escrow, I think, was meant by counsel for Senator Obama to really send a notice that this is what we have in mind, that there's no deductions, there's no later requests for use for another purpose. The money goes back in full, no deductions of any kind. The word escrow has a connotation that there's a third party involved, and I think it's uncomfortable with the use of it if it were to remain, because I think you can have a trust relationship where a person has two capacities. And in this case, there's a built-in protection that's offered, namely that the candidate would not be able to withdraw the funds personally, but it would only be the treasurer and the CEO who have very different responsibilities legally. So I think it's I see it as a trust relationship and not akin, therefore, to the other ways that funds are used in a commingled way in other circumstances under our regulations. And lastly, I do think that, and I'm comfortable with the interpretation, I do understand the fact that the language is not clear, and an argument, a credible argument, can be made that we can interpret receive and accept in different ways. But a recent publication that I was reading recently kind of made it clear to me that in a case like this where you look at the fundamental value that is being considered, and that is the preservation of the overall system, the overall funding program, we must look at how those words were intended, would have been intended to have been interpreted, and not be harnessed, as I think, or held hostage, I think, as Justice Stephen Breyer said in his recent book, with words that were used for purposes, but not for other purposes not yet conceived. And that certainly was the case here. I think our legislators had did not have in mind, and there's no history in the legislation that would suggest that they had this kind of situation in mind. So with that, I'm pleased to support it, and I want to thank the chairman for his leadership in moving this through as quickly as he could.
Very good. Thank you. And just to reiterate, the removal of the words escrow was, again, an acknowledgement that that term has a very specific legal meaning about third-party control, and we weren't entirely sure that that was necessary. There certainly are a number of safeguards, not the least of which being, as Senator Obama's counsel knows, were he to accept public financing, he would also have to enjoy the pleasure of a great deal of time with the FEC auditors at the end of the process. And so there is a number of safeguards in place, obviously, to discern how those funds would be used if he were to have accepted public financing. Other thoughts? Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree on the escrow point. I think I was the first one who raised it, and my concern was exactly what the chairman said, that all my lawyer colleagues knew what it meant, and I thought I knew what it meant, and I looked it up, and everywhere I looked it said third party. And as I can see it, there isn't a third party here. I understand Commissioner Walter's concern that this money be completely separate, and that separateness requirement is here. If we get a different request, he and I may disagree. But at least as to this one, that's fine. And so, no, I'm not intending a substantive change, but I didn't want to confuse us by using a perhaps technically inappropriate legal term. It reminds me of a 1983 petition I saw one time that was headed habeas corpus delicti. with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to move approval of the draft advisory opinion with the amendments set forth in Agenda Document 0712-A, except that in the third sentence of the long paragraph in 012-A, we would strike that and replace it with who.
Very good. Madam Secretary, is it clear which... where that has been removed. Very good. Thank you. So the vice chairman has moved adoption of agenda document 07-10 as amended by agenda document 07-12 as amended by 07-12A with the addition amendment of the table of replacing the word that with the word who in the sentence that begins on the fifth line of the third addendum. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Our lawyers, thank you. The third item on our agenda is the draft proposed policy statement regarding Commission actions in matters at the initial stage in the enforcement process. We have a late submitted document here as well, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider agenda document 0714.
Very good. The Vice Chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor indicate by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We have presenting today both Lynn Tran and Mark Schonkweiler from the General Counsel's Office. Ms. Tran?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before the Commission is the proposed policy statement regarding Commission action in matters at the initial stage in the enforcement process. The proposed policy statement specifies that at this stage in the enforcement process, the Commission may take one of four actions with respect to a matter under review: find reason to believe a respondent has violated the Act, dismiss the matter with admonishment, or find no reason to believe a respondent has violated the Act. The proposed policy statement is intended to clarify the circumstances under which the Commission may use each of these findings and to provide complainants, respondents, and the public with an explanation of the differences between each of these findings. I'd also like to note a technical correction on page 2 of the draft proposed policy statement, line 17. The site that currently reads 11 CFR 110.10F should read 11 CFR 111.10F.
One more time. 11 CFR.
It currently reads 110.10F. It should read 111.10F.
Very good. Discussion? Vice Chairman Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Categorization of actions, it was derived from something I had suggested initially, and I want to thank my colleagues for being open to it. I want to thank the chairman and his staff for working through some of the details, and general counsel staff as well for working hard and getting the kinks and details worked out. You know, everybody left after the last, or half people left after the last AO. I actually think this is more important than the Obama AO, because it helps to answer a question that people have asked me at least since I've gotten here, which is, what did that mean? And in particular, the Commission had its hands tied a little bit by this language that was used in the statute about reason to believe, which I believe historically was there first, and then when Congress came along and revised the procedure, they added the probable cause stage, and what was the implication? What did it mean when the Commission found reason to believe? Well, we all know here that the statutory purpose of a reason to believe finding is the predicate for opening an investigation. Nothing more. Doesn't necessarily mean that we think someone broke the law. But sometimes we would use a reason to believe finding, usually coupled with an admonition or something else, as an expression of an opinion that we, in fact, thought somebody had broken the law. And so that led, I think, to some confusion, which was even described by our litigators at one point. And they said they're in court defending an A8 suit, and the judge wanted to know, well, what does that mean? So we now will have a document to point to it. And what I think is the critical point here is that from this point forward, the reason to believe finding will be used
only to open an investigation or to move a proceeding further along in the process if we think we don't need an investigation. And in every case that I can imagine, a reason to believe finding will be followed by some subsequent statement that says either, well, we investigated it and concluded there was nothing there, or we investigated it or pursued conciliation and found there was something there, but there will be some sort of follow-up. And so we won't leave a reason to believe finding out there as some kind of cloud on somebody's reputation just because we got a complaint and we're obligated to investigate it. I think it'll also help in terms of on the other side where we think a complaint is totally without merit, or we think the response has answered it completely, again, on the other hand, where we think that there has been a violation of the law, this is not one we want to pursue. And so I think it sort of lays these things out much more clearly and should be of help in obtaining compliance with the Act, and also in making sure that people who are blameworthy get blame for whatever purpose that may serve, and those who are not escape that.
Thank you. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to express my appreciation both to the staff and to Commissioner Mason for his leadership on this. I know he and I are the old-timers here. Ever since I've been here, not quite as long as Commissioner Mason, I've been frustrated by the dilemma that we leave people in when we find reason to believe, and then ultimately, after an investigation, we decide that there really wasn't anything there. We couldn't dismiss it in the first instance because we weren't sure. But then we just dismiss, but we never take back the finding. You know, that reason to believe finding is just sort of out there. And I think this is going to be very helpful in providing clarity to people and, as Commissioner Mason said, you know, not leaving people with a cloud over their head unnecessarily. And clarity is a good thing. It's a good result.
Very good. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Well, I just want to echo Commissioner Weintraub's statements, but I also want to point out, and this is something very important that the Vice Chairman pointed out, that you know all the news today will be made by the Obama case, and this policy we're going to adopt is going to affect every enforcement case from now on. And I want to compliment both the Office of General Counsel for their work on this and my other commissioners, and the public needs to know, I just counted it up this morning. This is the sixth new policy statement we've adopted within the last 6 months. All of them on embezzlement, best efforts, purposes of disbursement, sua sponte, and probable cause hearings. Every one of them has been adopted unanimously, which indicates the shared goal of the commissioners to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of what we do here. And as Commissioner Weintraub and I are always talking, provide transparency in what we do. And there's been a real effort here to improve this. I mean, the adoption of that hearings policy, that was something the ABA noted as a deficiency here in 1983. And we finally have adopted that. And I was speaking to a former commissioner about it who, when he found out that we had not only adopted it, but all six commissioners had voted for it, he was just astonished that this had finally gotten done. And so I think coming off what was one of the most successful years of the agency's history in terms of enforcement, you know, twice as much collected in civil penalties as ever, largest number of enforcement cases closed in its history, and at the same time, we're doing everything we can to improve our policies. And, I mean, the regulated community ought to be very happy that we are, at the same time that we're doing good enforcement, also changing our procedures for the better. And that's really what ought to be the news about this. So I fully intend to support this.
Very good. Thank you. Commissioner Walter?
I'd like to add just that it's nice to have some clarity here on the commission table, because when I first got here and was looking at some of the issues that came before us, I said, well, I really don't believe there's a violation here, and it says I've got to have a reason to believe. And they said, don't worry about that. You don't have to have a reason to believe there's a violation. And now it's clear that we're really only talking about an investigation. You have a reason to believe to investigate, not that there's a violation. And the stigma of the use of those three words is now gone here at the table. and elsewhere now, too.
Very good. I often reach points in these meetings where the old adage attributed to Mo Udall comes to mind, where he was equipped at some point. Everything's been said, but not everyone said it. So I'll try and restrain myself from reiterating what's been said before, but I agree. I mean, this is, I think, another one of a series of improvements to our practices and procedures, and a helpful one at that. I think all commissioners have participated in these. This particular one, I think, had its genesis, no doubt, and from Commissioner or Vice Chairman Mason, who was able to solve a particularly difficult problem we were dealing on the enforcement side by sort of revising an idea that had bounced around years ago of amending how some of these cases are closed out. I also wanted to be more specific. Lynn Tran, Mark Schrankweiler worked very, very quickly. The quality of their work product was very, very high, and it's reflected in this document today. And I wanted to very specifically thank the both of you for your efforts in this area. Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to spoil the support from Commissioner Von Spakovsky, but I would note that not everyone is in the regulated community is happy with an efficient enforcement agency. I think it's a good thing, but... I move approval of the draft policy statement as set forth in Agenda Document 0714.
Very good. The Vice Chairman has moved the adoption of agenda document.
With the amendment previously stated.
Okay. Has moved the adoption of agenda document 07-14 with the amendment previously stated. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Very good. That brings us to the last item on our agenda. Ms. Masonette, are there any other management or administrative matters to address today? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Sigmund, you're the representative of the staff director here today. I apologize.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are none today.
Very good. With that, we will call to close the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, March 1st. Thank you.